You are listening to the Experience 50 podcast for midlife. I'm your host, Mary Rogers. This is episode 167. Hey guys, welcome back to the Experience 50 podcast. So glad that you are here. Want to just say, wherever you listen to your podcasts, be sure you're subscribed to the Experience 50 podcast for midlife. We're everywhere. We're on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Anywhere you look, you're going to find this show. So be sure that you subscribe so you never miss an episode. Also, get on the email list if you want to get updates from me. That would be right on the website, experience50.com. So great episode for you today. A really in-depth conversation with an ordinary woman who had an extraordinary midlife transformation. Here we go. So today I'm as surprised as anyone about the book that I am going to be discussing with the author. The name of the book is 50 After 50, Reframing the Next Chapter of Your Life. And I get so many books and articles and ebooks that arrive, you know, either in my inbox or my mailbox that want to talk about 50 things to do after 50. And my experience has been that usually these are kind of fluffy, stupid lists of, you know, just to inspire you or make you feel like, oh my God, I'm hardly living. And then some life coach wants to teach you how to be the kind of person who would do these 50 things. So when this book came to my attention, I really kind of initially dismissed it, to be perfectly honest. And then I did go a little deeper and I read up on the author, Maria Leonard Olson. And here's what I learned. Maria Leonard Olson is the mother of two children, a lawyer, a journalist, and author of two children's books. She leads writing empowerment retreats for women and is a co-host of the Inside Out radio show on WPFW in DC. Now, you know I'm an old radio girl, so I was a little more interested than I normally would be. She's a graduate of Boston College and the University of Virginia School of Law. Maria served in the Clinton administration's Justice Department, has served on several boards, and is a sought-after public speaker. She's written for the Washington Post, Washingtonian, Bethesda Magazine, Parenting, Baby Talk, Washington for Women. You're kind of getting the idea here, like I did, folks, that this was a very impressive woman. Also, she's recently returned to practicing law now that her children are launched. In 2016, she published Not the Cleaver Family, The New Normal in Modern American Family, and now her latest book that I'm holding in my hand, 50 After 50, Reframing the Next Chapter of Your Life. This was published in 2018. I devoured it in 3 hours, sitting on my deck, and just, I was turning each page thinking, I want every person I know to read this book. It was not what I expected. So joining us is the author, Maria Leonard Olson. Welcome to the show.
Mary, thank you so much for having me and for that kind introduction. My gosh, that was really wonderful. I'm honored to be on your show. I'm a big fan. It's nice to be on the other side from the listeners at this point and to share my experience, strength, and hope with you.
Well, here's what I took away when I read about you is, well, isn't that tidy? This woman really has her shit together. And now she's gonna teach me how I can be as awesome as she is. And then I started reading the book and the preface, it's the first paragraph, just hit me. So would you share that with my friends who are listening?
Of course. I entitled the preface, Maria 2.0, or Out of the Mud Comes the Lotus. At age 50, I drank my way out of my 25-year marriage. I had, against advice I knew, put all my eggs in the motherhood basket, willfully derailing my successful law career. As teenagers, my precious children did not need me in the hands-on way they had previously. In fact, they were dirtying the nest in preparation for going off to college and beyond. My husband and I had grown apart because, among other things that were entirely my fault, we failed to nurture that important relationship. I was depressed and stuck. So, while from the outside, I looked like Martha Effin Stewart hosting the welcoming committee of my Tony neighborhood, belonging to a yacht club, belonging to a country club, being on all sorts of committees, running all sorts of things at the kids' private schools, I was like a duck, looked kind of placid from the outside along the skimming the water, but underneath I was running so hard to keep myself from having to be introspective, to keep myself from letting anyone know what I really felt and believed about myself and all the self-hatred that I was harboring.
I really want to thank you for sharing that with us and for writing about it in the book, because I believe that there are so many people, men and women, as they're going through their later 40s, and they've kept this persona going, and it's hard work. It's really hard work. But other people don't know it. They think that, wow, she is just dynamite. It looks so easy for her.
Yes, and especially in this social media-infused society in which we live, where people generally only post the highlight reels, nothing really heavy, it's easy to believe that everyone else has it easy. But everyone has mud. They just deal with it in different ways. And I think one of the gifts of this process and of aging in general is learning that everyone has something and learning that no one can make us feel a certain way without our giving them permission.
Very interesting. So on this show, we talk a lot about that transformational process or the pivot. And for some people, there's a triggering event of some type or something that just puts the wheels in motion that is going to lead to some very messy, icky, gooey times of, you know, it's never a clean break from one phase of life to the next. So when you were 46, you realized that you were not at your best and you began taking antidepressants,
which was, it was following the death of my father when a lot of childhood stuff bubbled to the surface. My story includes childhood trauma, sexual assault. One in four women will have been sexually assaulted in their lifetimes. And so few of us talk about that. And my father also was an alcoholic when I was growing up. So it brought to the forefront a lot of things that I had avoided. And trauma, not dealing with traumatic issues from your past, is like holding a beach ball underwater. It's something you can do, but it takes a tremendous amount of psychic energy. And if not dealt with, it pops up in various ways. I would lash out at someone, not because of something they did, but because they triggered a memory in me of a trauma I had never dealt with before, had never fully processed. I just ignored it and pretended things didn't happen. So at 46, when I started on antidepressants, my drinking really ramped up. And when you take antidepressants and drink, the effect of the alcohol is magnified greatly because of the antidepressants. So my drinking got completely out of control and became a 2-bottle of wine habit, drinking by myself. And it led to a parade of horribles in my life, as you can imagine.
So by the time you were 49, where were your kids? When you were 49, were the kids still home?
Well, one was home and was a senior heading off to college, and one had gone off to an arts boarding school. He is in musical theater. He was on his way out as well.
Okay. So the empty nest was within view at that point. You're
Yes.
drinking 2 bottles of wine every night, all on your own, like a real champ.
Starting at noon, actually, I used to say I wouldn't drink after 5. Then it became 4. Then it became 2. Then it became 1. Then it became noon and 11 and earlier.
And so was there a triggering? Well, I'm just going to jump forward a little and share with my friends. So here I am sitting on my deck, opening up this book, that on the cover, again, the title of it is 50 After 50, Reframing the Next Chapter of Your Life. And after reading that preface where Maria confesses that, at 50, she drank her way out of a marriage and that this perfect life that I had read in her bio was, in fact, not really what was going on. Well, you get to chapter one, and the next 30 pages are about Maria going through 4 or 5 different rehab sessions, and it's all about the 12 steps in drinking and or recovering from being an alcoholic. And I keep going back to the cover of the book, going, wait a minute, is this a book about recovery? Because I thought this was this light list of 50 fun things to do to celebrate being 50. And I real and the writing is so beautiful. And you're a very smart writer, Maria. And
Oh,
this is
thank
what I
you.
really It is very clear that she is a highly educated attorney who understands how to communicate very clearly. There's not a lot of fluff in here, folks. It is heart-wrenchingly honest writing that's just very smart, is I guess the I wish I had better words to describe this.
Well, I really appreciate that. It was terribly self-revelatory, but now I have gotten to the point where I strive to turn my pain into a force for good. I also learned through these rehabs, and through Alcoholics Anonymous that secrets keep us sick. And so until I could fully process the trauma and the secrets of my youth, I couldn't be fully whole. And I would always be wearing masks. And so, allowing my readers and trusted women in my life to bear witness to my pain and my trauma allowed me to heal and to move on. And since I got to this incredible place of self-love following this year of magical doing and thinking, I wanted to share that with other people and to help women who hide the fact that they were sexually assaulted or sexually abused, to help the women who drink alone and don't think that they are alcoholics because we have a misconception, a social construct that alcoholics are the bums under the bridge. Well, they're not. There are so many women suffering alone. And since I wrote this book, people have come to me and asked, can I go to a meeting with you? How do I help myself out of this hole? I'm depressed too. I don't know what to do with this depression, or I'm in a divot in life. How did you get past this? So, as you said in your introduction, there are many women who are listeners, readers out there who are stuck in a divot in life and don't know how to get out of it. Sometimes it's the result of past trauma, sometimes it's boredom. Sometimes it's being in a loveless marriage. It could be all kinds of things, but 50 is a reckoning point for most of us.
Yeah,
And
and it could just be that you're living a life that does not feel right to you.
right.
You're
That isn't
living
aligned with
someone
your
else's life.
values. Exactly. I believe that I had subjugated my desires to be the person my very proper ex-husband wanted me to be. And I was losing my personality and myself in what everyone else wanted of me. So I had not the courage to figure out what exactly were my values? What exactly did I want out of this life until I turned 50? Actuarially speaking, realizing that I'm in the third of my life now. And that time is the one thing we can't manufacture or get back. And if we waste it, that's on us. It's of limited duration. So I changed almost everything about my life during my 50th year.
And so for you, it was going through different types of rehab programs. And you talk about the 12-step program, which, you know, it can be for drinkers or gamblers or shoppers or smokers or whatever your addiction is. But I really liked what you said in the book about you suggest that for anyone who feels that they are on the first step of a transformation or they would like a transformation, that the 12-step approach really works for everybody.
Yes, it does. It's a guide for living. It is a map for being a good human. It's about believing in something bigger than yourself. It's about working on your character defects, about making amends when you have made a mistake, about paying it forward. And all of those things, which that's a generalization of vast simplification of what the 12 steps are, but it helped me chart a better course for myself, to own up to any of the failings of my past, to make amends to people that I felt that I needed to make amends to clean up my side of the street so that I could walk, hold my head up high and believe that I had done everything I needed to do to clean up my side of the street.
Well, as you said, you didn't have a drinking problem. You had a living problem.
Exactly. And I would also encourage your listeners, if they are interested in having better relationships with anyone, to check out an open meeting of Al-Anon. Al-Anon is for people who are in relationship with their friend, family member, or even a colleague at work, with someone who is in addiction, alcoholism, or even is just a difficult person. It's about how to have healthy relationships, including how to set healthy boundaries, which is something I did not have. As someone who whose boundaries had been violated as a child, I realized boundary setting was something that was challenging for me.
One of the things that you discuss, and I have been focusing on this topic quite a bit lately, of adjusting to the empty nest. At this point, mm-hmm. I think I am 19 days away, as we're recording this, from becoming an empty nester after 38 years of raising children. So it's very much in the front of my mind. But you make a really good point about how some parents become literally codependent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is a term we get used to in addiction. Can you explain for someone who doesn't really understand that term what you meant by that?
Yes, codependency can kill you. It is about, there are 12-step groups called Codependence Anonymous. What it is when your happiness depends on the happiness of someone else. When my children were unhappy, I was unhappy. I felt responsible for their happiness. And that made separating from them as they, if we do our jobs as parents, our children are supposed to be able to fly from the nest. They're supposed to be able to be independent. The more they pushed me away, the more the sense of my worth plummeted because I had put all my eggs in the motherhood basket. I had given everything to my kids that I could have given them. I felt that no one could give to them what I gave to them. And it was also a reflection of some of the hurt from my youth, where my mother was a working mom. I lived with my father. They split up when I was younger. My father tried to have my mother, who is an immigrant from the Philippines, deported. I never had anyone at home. I was basically a latchkey kid. So I wanted to fulfill kind of the fantasy of what I thought I had lost out on as a child. And we all have childhood baggage that somehow informs or affects our adult experiences. And when the kids pushed me away, as I was training them to do, it was very difficult for me. I had to learn that my happiness need not depend on their happiness. And in fact, that was an unhealthy paradigm that had been set up by me. So I needed to learn what exactly made me happy, which sounds ridiculous, that I couldn't think of a single thing other than my kids that made me happy.
Oh, you're not alone in that. I think that that is incredibly common, that sentiment. Mm. Now, then later in the book, you talk about in going through the 12 steps, the importance of each person having a relationship with their higher self. And some people call that God, whatever the universe, whatever you call it. But I thought it was so interesting that you related that back to motherhood and your children and how tough it was for you to realize that you were not your children's higher power.
Higher power, yes.
That they had their own
higher power, and it was not me. Yes, I fancied myself their higher power. When they're so little, you're able to protect them. But as they go out in the world, you can no longer protect them from every eventuality. It's impossible. And for this control freak, that was a harsh realization.
I just want my listener to really hold on to that and think about it for a while, the fact that you are not your child's higher power. I do think that we fall into that trap of thinking that we can create all the circumstances around our child and smooth them out and steer them in the right path. And that's not our job.
No, and it's impossible. And if we think that that is our job, we will make ourselves crazy, as I did.
Yeah.
Until I was able to let go and let God. I choose to call my higher power God. But your higher power can be the universe. It can be just anything bigger than yourself. In AA and Al-Anon, frequently, the higher power of the participants is the group of people, the power of the we in overcoming adversity of any sort.
Mm-hmm. And again, folks, when you're listening, keep in mind that this is Maria and I are not just speaking to people with addictions. This is, I hope, touching anyone who is approaching 50 and looking for that transformation, that in some way your persona and your circumstances are not feeling that they are aligned with who you wish to become at this point, that you're in that stage of questioning your values and your decisions, and you have this beautiful opportunity around the age of 50 to begin pivoting. And you can do it in small ways, you can do it in big ways. Some of us have a much bigger challenge if, like Maria, you are coming into this feeling empty and depressed and an alcoholic. So not to lessen your experience, Maria, but for some people, even without the alcoholism, this is such a, I mean, just like you were when you went on the antidepressants after your dad died, and then it turned into drinking, but it could just turn into a deeper and deeper and deeper depression and anxiety, and people feel stuck. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about, because one of the hallmarks, I think, of this idea, you know, at 50 years old, I don't care what people think of me anymore. I just don't care. And for some people, that means I just don't care. Instead of driving a Mercedes, I'm going to drive a Volvo. I don't care what people think. Do you know? But your story is so drastic that you went from the yacht club experience and your husband, as you went to your fifth round of rehab, he decided he had had enough.
Yes, he had.
You kind of understand and forgive him for that. Is that my understanding?
I do. I mean, I came from a broken home, and so I did not want to get divorced, but I know that he had to protect himself as well. He had to protect his own heart. And I had gone so far down the rabbit hole that I don't begrudge him what he needed to do to protect himself.
Yeah, he stayed with you when you were circling the drain, but it went on for
Yes.
too many years for him to stay there with you.
Exactly.
Okay. So you had to make some very drastic lifestyle changes once you were sober and you had a divorce financial settlement with your husband, but your circumstances were now extremely different. You were no longer a member of the yacht club.
Right. It was quite a jarring change. But one of the things that I did to help me through this transition was to volunteer in a very, very poor part of the world, which for me was an exercise in cultivating gratitude because I wanted to focus on all that I had instead of all that I had lost at that point.
Well, and this is where I should note that this is where the big chunk of the book begins, is that now Maria is sober, she's divorced, she's lost her financial standing in her community. Many of her friends have been like, if you aren't coming to Garden Club, you're not part of our posse anymore. And so she decides, well, why don't you share this part? How did you come up with the idea of, all right, whole new version of myself, sober, I need a project?
Right. Well, one of the th travel is one of my favorite things to do, and I believe it's a large part of my education is traveling to learn how other people live in the world and how privileged we are just by virtue of living in the United States to know that we'll have clean water, that we are likely to eat something today, for instance. So I sold many of my things. I put the rest in storage and I moved to the other side of the world, high in the Himalayas, the poorest part of Nepal, because I have a friend who is from Nepal and was doing some relief work there and helped connect me with this school in the Himalayas. I lived there in a house with no running water, no heat, and an outhouse, and volunteered in the school, brought a bunch of school supplies and helped to build a library there, and learned that the vast majority of the world gets along with so much less than we do here in the United States. And I wanted to also begin to free myself from the tyranny of things that govern so much of what my life was like before this transition. So that experience set the stage for a much different view, a worldview. When I got back to the US, I was at a restaurant, a very casual restaurant, but I happened to go into the restroom and I started marveling at how clean it was. And I said, "Oh my gosh, it smells so good in here." And everyone ran out of the room and thought, "There's a crazy woman in the bathroom." But I will no longer take for granted paper towels, hot and cold water, or all of the things that I had taken for granted before that move to Nepal and that experience.
Well, and so your list of 50 things after 50, my takeaway was these were not 50 fun things that, golly jeepers, Sherry, you should really try this. These are the 50 experiences that Maria shares with her readers that helped her to become the new person that she is. That,
Maria 2.0, exactly. It was to help me explore the contours of what
yeah.
the next part of my life to look like. And not any of everything in the list of 50 are things that I will ever do again, but I wanted to stretch my comfort zone and try different
Yeah,
things.
and you probably didn't even realize the lessons that you would learn in these different experiences when you set out to do them, because there's no way you could have. But that's what the book is. That's what's so beautiful about this book, is that within each of these 50 things that she did, she tells the story of what she did and the really serendipitous experiences that occurred along the way and what she learned about herself in the process.
Thank you. Thank you. That is exactly what I set out to do. And you're right. I did not know how many of these things would affect me. I did not know that taking up meditation, for instance, would change my life. That even walking meditation, if I don't have time to do a sitting meditation, walking from my car to my office door and becoming present by focusing on my own breathing would set the stage for a much calmer workday.
Yeah. Folks, let me tell you that Maria is, she was raised Catholic and fairly conservative. Some of the, as you say, watch out for the woo-woo, because some of the stuff in this book is so crazy that you did. And I do, the one thing that you wrote about that when I read it, I was thinking, oh, that sounds really kind of cool, but I just cannot picture myself doing this. And can you, do you have a good guess of which one I'm talking about?
It's either the floating isolation tank or the Women of the Wild.
The Women of the Wild. There you go.
Yes, Women of the Wild. My friends could not believe that I had done that sort of retreat, which culminated in many of us dancing around the fire naked, yelling blank power to the moon. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on the air.
Oh, yeah, you are.
Yelling pussy power to the moon. It was just a crazy, liberating, fun, who cares what we look like experience. And for this buttoned up former PTA mom, that was a sea change. It was something that my Catholic school, high school girlfriends said they could not believe that was me.
What a freeing experience. I mean, I really don't know that I could do it. And I don't like that about myself.
Yes. I mean, it's the whole dance like no one is watching. And I have to admit, I was not as free as the younger women in the group. At one point, I just took my clothes off really fast, danced around the fire, put them back on. I have that pre-Vatican II Catholic repression as part of my psyche.
Well, so let me bring this back to what I was saying earlier about one of the hallmarks of turning 50, I believe, is the idea of I don't care what people think of me. So yes. This is an example of, you know, what you were just saying is the idea of doing something like that. I think that's probably the truest version of I don't care what people think of me, because, I mean, you really put yourself out of there, but also releasing yourself from the trappings of financial security. And you talk about, and you'll have to help me a little bit with this, but you were working someplace that was not, you know, a top drawer Washington, D.C. law firm, and people came in who knew you, and you were working like in a retail setting, I think. Mm-hmm. Tell that story.
Yes. I do some book events for a local bookstore, the biggest independent bookseller in the Washington area. And I love books. I love talking to authors. So I, in my free time, work at book selling events. And I was at this very exclusive women's club in downtown Washington, behind the table selling the books. And some people who I knew from my previous very privileged life looked upon me with such pity. And at first that made me my self-esteem plummet. And then I thought to myself, you know, that really says a lot more about them than it does about me. I enjoy what I'm doing, and I'm not giving them permission to make me feel diminished in any way. because I know I am living a life authentic to myself and my values. I love authors. I love reading, and I'm happy to be here. And no, I will not give you permission to make me feel otherwise.
And I think that is something that people say to themselves, and they say it over and over and over until they believe it. Because that is something that takes, a long time to get to truly believe it to your bones. You know, a lot of people say it. I don't care what people think of me. Mm-hmm. But there's a long trail to where that becomes actually true. And these were the types of lessons that I read over and over and over in Maria's book, that by her telling of the stories, you could tell these weren't just platitudes. These weren't, you know, just things you read on little framed art and TJ Maxx. Because your life just, I think, because life kicked you in the teeth several times as a child, as a young girl, and then through just this crazy materialistic world that we live in, that you were, you know, doing the duck routine of, you know, mm-hmm. your little feet underwater, the death of your dad, the drinking, all of the revelation that you went through in recovery, and your experiences that you wrote about for this book, you're the real deal.
Well, I thank you. They were very hard fought lessons, and it took a great deal out of me to learn to believe affirmations. I believe, I was taught in the rehab, the first rehab, that I was supposed to say affirmations in the mirror. And I thought that was a ridiculous waste of time, that I am enough, that I am going to learn from this experience, that every person in situation has the capacity to teach me something if I am open to the lesson. All of these things that I didn't really believe, but after 30 days of saying them in the mirror, they started to ring true for me. And I'd love to share one other story that illustrates this point. This was when I got my motorcycle license and bought myself a small used motorcycle. My kids were horrified, but I told them, when you turn 50, I will support you getting a motorcycle as well. So I was practicing riding my motorcycle around a suburb in DC and ran into a woman whose son went to my son's same Tony prep school. Her mouth dropped open. Her jaw dropped open. She just followed me with her eyes in disbelief. I pulled over and I said, "Hi, how are you?" She said, "Maria, is that your motorcycle?" I said, "Yes, it is. My kids are horrified." And she said, "So am I." At that moment, I felt shame descending on my shoulders. And I said to my shame, "You are not welcome here." And I said, "Well, gotta go." Revved it full throttle and took off, feeling so free and so happy that I had walked the walk of my affirmation that no one is going to make me feel a certain way without my giving them permission. And for me, that was a huge, huge change in someone who had been governed so closely by what I thought other people thought of me. And the truth of the matter is that we cannot control what other people think of us. It's not our business, and it will make us crazy if we think we can control something that we cannot.
Yeah.
We can't control it.
There are different levels of that. You know, mm-hmm. I think that we have to, we can say it, you know, that you don't care, but it's when someone sees you on your motorcycle and looks at you with pity, you know, that's a real moment when someone looks at you, like when you were at the book selling table and mm-hmm. they look at you with pity, or that woman when you're on your motorcycle, you know, those are the moments where you really cement who you are.
Exactly. Yes.
So here's a question I have for you. And it's something that I read frequently in, you know, self-improvement books and books about people, you know, going through their midlife transitions. And I just want your opinion on this because I'm not sure what I think. So getting to, let's call the stage of authenticity. And so the way I look at our adulthood is that at first we're building up this persona based on, you know, what we basically get approval for. So we accommodate our world and our relationships and in becoming something. And then usually sometimes in our 40s, we start questioning these things that maybe this really isn't my bag. And so we start becoming who we should be, which this is the interesting, juicy part of midlife that I'm so interested in, is where we're not quite there, but we're becoming. So we're, you know, kind of like a football player walking in stilettos. We're trying this stuff on and seeing, mm-hmm. you know, seeing what works for us and what doesn't. And then ultimately we become an authentic or as near to authentic version of ourselves as we can. So I hear a lot of experts talking about that the effort you are in during that questioning and becoming time is to return to your authentic self, to find that authentic self that you ignored while you were accommodating the world. I'm not really comfortable with that. I think that you, maybe there was an authentic you at 20 or 30 that didn't happen, but I think it's a different authentic self at 50. Like, I think it's your new authentic self. Do you feel like you returned to your authentic self, or you became the best authentic person you could be at 50?
I think it's a mix, that we are different people at different points in our life. That for me, the fancy sort of life wasn't what I grew up with and didn't feel quite right. I never felt that I was part of this group of people that I found myself in at 49. I also, having been the only dark-skinned person in a sea of white people for most of my life in various school and work settings, I had the sense of being other for most of my life. So I tried my best to fit in so many ways. And if I, by virtue of trying to fit in for most of my life, I couldn't figure out who I was without that desire to just fit in. So I think the gift of aging, and particularly 50, is one of the gifts, is that typically our child rearing responsibilities are diminishing, and we are still physically, if we're lucky, able to walk, hike, move. And we're in that sweet spot before many of our parents go into true physical decline. So we have this golden opportunity to try a lot of different things, to try out some things to see if they resonate with who we really are. So I think it's an extraordinary time in our life that doesn't happen when you're 20, you're trying to figure out how you're going to make a living. When you're 30, you might be thinking about marriage or having kids. When you're 40, you may be in the thick of child rearing. So at 50, you get this pause to reevaluate. So I agree with you in that sense. And I would encourage your listeners to, as they want to determine their authentic selves, to look in various categories like I did. Like, look into what makes your heart sing. What sort of social activities, learning, teaching opportunities, physical challenges, spiritual endeavors, thrill-seeking ventures, lifestyle changes, and travel and adventure. Look at different facets of your life and see, where do things not feel as good? Where do things feel like they're working? And then to make some changes, because this is our sweet spot and the time in which we can do such things. That was my process and how I got to this more authentic place, which I don't think I could have gotten to at 20 or 30 or 40, because I hadn't processed the difficulties of my youth or the complex feelings and traumatic things that had happened to me when I was younger.
Well, and could you say something to my friend who is listening who may have some trauma in their family history or their personal history, particularly in their childhood or maybe their 20s? Because so many of us are taught, you know, just don't think about that. Just, you know, put that aside, stuff it down. And even when I talk to people in their 50s who are stuck on something, it's difficult to know, you know, how much focus someone should be putting on looking backwards when they want to transform moving forward. So what is your advice on becoming overwhelmed by your story?
Well, if you've never processed with a professional something that was truly traumatic in your life, then it is likely to continue to seep into your daily activities as you age. So I would encourage your listeners to allow a trusted friend and hopefully, if it's a very serious nature, a professional, a mental health professional, to trust them to bear witness to whatever it is that was your trauma. Because if one keeps it inside and never processes it, you'll never get past it. I'm not one to dwell on what happened. And I was very adept at compartmentalizing, which served me well in my younger years and led to much professional success. But later, when my world started to collapse, it came back to the surface because I hadn't dealt with it. So I am not of the mind that I need to confront the person or persons who assaulted me or abused me. And that is not a universal approach. But for me, I could heal by talking to a professional and allowing women to bear witness to my pain.
Yeah, I have heard that just about the most damaging thing that can happen to a child is to have some sort of trauma or abuse and go to their parents or the authorities and have it denied.
Yes. I can't even imagine what that would feel like. I counsel young women who have been date raped, for instance, and are not believed by their parents or by their schools. And it's re-traumatizing.
Absolutely. All right. Well, this, you know, if I could just gush all over you for another hour, I would, but I know you need to go be the awesome person you are. So we will wrap this up. The name of the book is 50 After 50, Reframing the Next Chapter of Your Life. My guest has been the author, Maria Leonard Olson. She has a wonderful website, also a Facebook page, which is 50 spelled out, F-I-F-T-Y, after 50, which is the digits 50. There are a lot of us 50 people in the Facebook world who, you know, are either spelling it or doing it numerically. Are there any other links that, and I will have the book on my website for sale through Amazon. So that's at experience50.com/167. You can get that there. Is there anything else you would like to share with my listeners who are now your fan club?
Oh, thank you. I would also like to mention that the book comes out in paperback this fall, and it's also on Audible, and that any library will carry it. And I guess I would say to your listeners in closing that it's your life. It's up to you what you do with it. And while it is next to impossible to live your every day as if it were your last, we can live every day as if it is New Year's, perhaps, as if it's a new chance for us to try living life the way we really want to, not the way other people expect of us.
Rock on, Maria Leonard Olson. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, that was just a fabulous conversation. I hope that you enjoyed it just as much as I did. You can order Maria's book through the website, experience50.com/167. I really recommend this book. There are two books in the midlife genre that I am just cuckoo crazy for. And one is now this one. Didn't expect it, but yep, this is one of my faves. The other one is from a guest that we had on like over 3 years ago, I think, Steve Oakes, who wrote Mid Men. Excellent book. And even though it's written for men, it is purchased by more women than men. And it's one of my very, very favorite books, kind of a how-to philosophy of midlife. So those are my two top picks for books. Both are very gift appropriate for anyone you know who is turning 50. Okay, kids, you go have a fabulous day. I'm in the final stretch before becoming an empty nester. I think I've got about 13 days, something like that, before my youngest heads off to college. Pretty darn excited. A little scared and a little sad. But ain't that the way it goes? All right, you've got this. Bye.